Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Medication Adherence and Safety. I'm your host this evening, Dr. Sarah Embry, and Parent Talk Live Special Edition is sponsored by Forest of the Rain Productions in partnership with the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy, located in Charleston, West Virginia. The mission of Forest of the Rain Productions is to expand the voices of the seldom heard in education, fair housing, parental and family engagement, academic research, the business of education, and civic involvement. The University of Charleston School of Pharmacy offers its student pharmacists a technology-infused, dynamic, and rigorous curriculum that prepares graduates to practice in today's rapidly changing healthcare environment. Our mission is to prepare pharmacists who will provide comprehensive patient care, to advance the profession through research and advocacy, and to serve the community as leaders in rural health. Tonight is the third of four episodes of Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Medication Adherence and Safety. This show is an interactive discussion, and our listeners are welcome to join the conversation. You can do so by dialing 515-605-9859 and pressing the number 1 to let us know you have a question or comment. You can also follow the discussion via Twitter at anaturalbridge, at UCSOP, or at I Will Take My Meds. Tonight we are discussing an interprofessional approach to medication adherence and disease management. Our guests are Audrey Hayhurst and Omar Jabara from the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy Class of 2021, Patrick Snyder, UC Nursing Student Class of 2019, and Heidi Lane and Victoria Nguyen, UC Student Physician Assistants in the Class of 2020. Nearly 3 out of 4 Americans don't take their medications as directed, which can significantly impact their overall health. The Script Your Future campaign, in which the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy participates, encourages students from different healthcare professions to promote medication adherence through community outreach and asking patients to pledge to take their meds as prescribed. Each profession in the field of healthcare plays a unique role in medication adherence and disease management, but they do share a common goal: to improve the overall health of their patients. When each of these professions come together as a team, patients receive the best possible care and chronic disease states are most effectively managed. In this panel discussion, pharmacy, nursing, and physician assistant students from the University of Charleston will discuss what medication adherence means to different members of the healthcare team. We will talk about how these professions can work together to influence medication adherence and what impact this can have on patients, especially those with chronic disease states. We encourage you to tweet with us at UCSOP or at I Will Take My Meds, and invite you to join us by taking the pledge to take your meds as prescribed. Visit us at www.ucwv.edu/pharmacy and click on Take the Pledge. Individuals can customize their pledge this year by filling in the statement, I will. For example, I will take my meds because I want to spend more time with my grandchildren. I will take my meds for my health. I will take my meds because they save my life each and every day. Let's meet our guests. Up first is Audrey Hayhurst. Audrey is a second-year pharmacy student from the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy. She's originally from Fairmont, West Virginia, and she completed her undergraduate degrees in biology and psychology at Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. She currently serves as the vice president of the class of 2021 and as co-chair for the Script Your Future Medication Adherence Challenge. In addition, she is involved in the UCSOP Fellows Program and ROCHI. She is also passionate about being involved in the community. Omar Jabara is a student pharmacist from Detroit, Michigan. He is 23 years old and currently finishing his second year of pharmacy school at UCSOP. He has interest in pursuing a career in compounding pharmacy, and he also has an interest in pursuing fellowship beyond graduation and working with Big Pharma. He studied nutrition and food science at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan for his undergraduate education. He enjoys partaking in exercising and all types of sports, along with spending time with friends and family. Next is Patrick Snyder. Patrick is a second career nursing student who came to healthcare through civilian experiences with emergency medical services and volunteering 13 months with a Central American social nonprofit. He plans to merge his education background with his clinical skills to continue teaching healthcare simulation while working in a critical care environment. Patrick believes substance should supersede style and pulls for underdogs who've got grit and a growth mindset. Heidi Lane is currently a second-year student at the University of Charleston's Physician Assistant Program. Heidi earned her Bachelor of Science degree in biology from Southern Methodist University in 2008. After her undergraduate study, she spent 3 years working for the Pediatric Infectious Disease Department at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. She went on to obtain a Master of Science in Medical Sciences from the University of North Texas Health Science Center. Prior to her PA training, Heidi spent 1 year as a scribe in the emergency department and 2 years as a medical assistant in a large, busy private dermatology practice. Finally, we have Victoria Nguyen. Victoria is currently a second-year student at the University of Charleston Physician Assistant Program. During her didactic career in the program, she has held the position of Vice President of the University of Charleston PA Student Association. Prior to her PA training, Victoria was part of the healthcare team as a medical assistant in a busy reproductive endocrinology and fertility academic private clinic that was affiliated with the University of North Carolina. She also has experience working in urology, urgent care, optometry, home health, and family practice settings. She received her undergraduate training in biology at the University of Georgia and studied graduate-level nutrition at Meredith College. We certainly have a wide variety of guests with us this evening with a lot of qualifications. So welcome to all of our guests this evening. Now's a great time for me to turn it over to you all to answer some questions. So first, if each of you could describe a little bit about your role in as your professions, what do each of those individuals play as part of the healthcare team?
Hey, this is Omar. In a community setting, as a pharmacist, we're most likely the last person or healthcare professional to interact with the patient. So I think pharmacists play a big role in counseling, educating, and advocating to the patients in regard to their regimen for their medications.
This is Patrick, the nursing student. Nurses, I mostly have experience in the hospital, and we are some of the first people that patients will see, especially in the emergency department, coming through that way. And I guess also in the outpatient setting as well. We do a lot of constant assessment and reassessment on patient statuses and are kind of the go-between or the liaison with the care coordination with the healthcare team.
This is Heidi, one of the PA students. And PAs are medical professionals who diagnose illness. They actually develop and manage the treatment plans, prescribe those medications, and in the community, we often serve as the principal healthcare professional.
This is Audrey. I do want to add, pharmacists do a lot more than just fill prescriptions. We actually also work in clinical settings, such as maybe in the hospital or in your doctor's office, where we will educate patients on their medications and even make suggestions on the medication treatments for patients.
Great. So everyone working together really helps to create the optimal plan for the patient, from what I understand, especially like we discussed, if the patient has some type of chronic disease state or a long-term health issue that they are currently dealing with. So what does medication mean to each of you as healthcare professionals?
Well, this is Audrey again. Medication adherence really means taking your medication as prescribed. So that's what your doctor or your PA has written on the prescription label. So that's, you know, taking it, if it says to take it twice a day, you take it twice a day. Not missing doses, that sort of thing.
This is Omar. I believe medication adherence is extremely important to achieve an optimal outcome for the patient, and especially in the long run, we can reduce healthcare costs for the patient, and that's an important factor, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. This is Patrick, the nursing student. In the critical care settings, to piggyback what Audrey and Omar were saying, not only that, but if you come in, we're like in a situation where time is of the essence, it's only going to make a critical situation more difficult if you are not taking your medications as prescribed as what we see in the chart. Then we're going to have to do more, let's say, blood draws and lab tests in order to ensure that your metabolism is functioning the way we perceive it should be based on your chart. And not only that, but if you aren't taking the medications as prescribed, then that could increase your risk factors and your comorbidities for other complications, basically.
This is Victoria, BPA student, and I think that medical medication adherence is misunderstood as just the patient's responsibility, when in reality, it's a responsibility that belongs to every team player of the healthcare team.
Awesome. And Patrick, I want to talk to you a little bit more. I think a lot of the listeners perhaps are more familiar with outpatient settings or seeing their regular doctor, again, on an outpatient basis, and are a little bit less familiar with the hospital environment. Can you walk us through an example of a patient coming in and really being in bad shape when they hit the emergency room and how medication adherence takes a bit of a shift in that type of situation?
Right. I think some of the examples that come to mind are, for instance, with diabetes, with some of the chronic disease processes that maybe I perceive that the listeners are more comfortable and more familiar with, like diabetes and taking insulin or any other diabetic pill medication. If they're not taking as prescribed, then wound healing can be prolonged and take much more time, which could lead to a complication like a bloodstream infection, which could lead to sepsis, and which is it just basically could spiral out of control from just a simple wound that if the diabetes medication were taken properly, that more or less would heal, quote unquote, on time. But with that delayed wound healing, if it's not kept clean, and we see it pretty regularly, this isn't just like, I guess I should clarify, when I say things, quote, could happen, this isn't like, oh, like there's a 1% chance that this could happen. This is pretty common with non-compliant diabetics, whether it's intentional or not, with their medication regimen, that their wound healing is much more prolonged and complications very commonly occur.
So diabetes is one of the disease states that the Scripture Future campaign really does focus on a lot. Along with other disease states such as cardiovascular disease and respiratory conditions. So we've touched on diabetes management and why it is so important, but would any of you like to address the importance of medication adherence in either cardiovascular disease or in respiratory disorders as well, and really talk about potentially some of the complications that can arise if patients are not taking their medications with those disease states?
I can do one more story real quick. This is Patrick again, the nursing student. We actually had in the emergency department a week or two ago, we had a woman come in with a GI bleed, and it was worthy of being in the emergency department, but it wasn't, you know, a level one critical patient or anything. And once we got her in her room and settled, we looked in her chart as we were kind of getting her settled and understanding her situation, and we noticed that she had been prescribed in the chart currently, give or take 10 to 15 medications, a lot of which actually dealt with cardiovascular disease and blood pressure and coronary artery disease. And when we asked, you know, could we start an IV, we're thinking this is most likely going to be the treatment regimen. She said, oh, no, I actually don't want any medication. I don't like to take medication, which I understand in Appalachia can be a taboo topic. However, if understood properly, then she wouldn't have had a blood pressure. I don't want to get too detailed into like medical, but she had a dangerously high blood pressure, and that could have, you know, my shift was about to end, so I didn't get to see this patient through or anything, but that could have complicated her GI bleed once something perforated in her bowels. I mean, having high pressure within her cardiovascular system didn't help anything. And when we asked her kind of what the barriers were to her medication regimen, taking it as prescribed, she mentioned that she's not, quote, a guinea pig. And in that moment, I didn't understand what all went into that comment. And unfortunately, that was kind of the end of shift. That was my last patient of the night. And I didn't get to look into it further, but that kind of threw me back.
So branching off of that, what do you think we can communicate as healthcare providers to patients to reinforce the big picture message that people are prescribed what they're prescribed due to evidence-based medicine. We're looking at guidelines. We're looking at literature. We're not just making this up as we go along and not leaving them to be the guinea pig, like the patient said. How can we communicate the thought and science that goes into some of these medication regimens in a way that's easy for individuals to understand?
Well, this is Audrey. I think that is a great role for the pharmacist. We do a lot of patient counseling, and as pharmacists, we can be more diligent about that, really explaining to the patients what their disease is, what the risks are if it goes untreated, and how that medication is helping. I think that's something that a lot of patients, unfortunately, don't get from their pharmacist sometimes, and that's definitely something that we as pharmacists can work on.
And this is Heidi, the PA student. I think that whole process starts with the provider. And unfortunately, in today's world of medicine, providers are often limited by how much time they have with each individual patient, but we have to strive to look at the patient as a whole. Not just, okay, you've got cardiovascular or heart disease, this is what we're going to give you. You have to look at the patient as a whole. If you think that they're not going to be compliant with their meds, the education portion starts with the provider. They have to try to do their best to get the patient to understand what the condition is, what will happen if they don't take the medications, and then explain what medications they need to either keep it under control, or to fix like a more acute condition, or if it's something more chronic like heart disease, medications that will keep you out of the hospital, that will keep you playing with your grandkids longer, and just being able to explain this is why you need to take it because this is what's going on with your body.
Great. So it's definitely one of those things that starts, like you said, with one provider or another, whether it's the physician assistant, the physician themselves, someone writing that prescription, and then carrying it on through to the rest of the individuals that kind of touch the patient in one way or another throughout the whole process. So we've talked about cardiovascular complications as well as diabetes. What about on the respiratory side of things? I think that especially here in West Virginia, where we have a huge portion of the patient population that is smoking or using some type of tobacco product, we think a lot about the respiratory complications that can come along with that. So what would that potentially entail?
This is Omar, the pharmacy student. Working in a pharmacy, I've had several patients coming in with inhaler prescriptions to treat their COPD. And when they came back to pick up their prescriptions, many of them couldn't afford the copay or just wasn't covered completely by their insurance and just didn't want to pay for the inhaler or adhere to the treatment whatsoever. But then we had to, of course, explain to them how we could just call the physician and potentially find another alternative, a cheaper alternative, or something that's fully covered by their insurance. But that's another thing with medication adherence is if they wouldn't have that inhaler or they would ration it out and get their inhaler every 2 months instead of every month, they could be experiencing more shortness of breath and, of course, complicating their morbidity to a further extent, causing more hospitalization stays and whatnot.
This is Heidi, the PA student. As irritating as the provider may be, at every office visit, if you have somebody that smokes, chews, dip, whatever, and even vaping now, everyone thinks that that's the next best thing as an alternative to actual tobacco smoking, but it is not. And I think it starts with the provider trying desperately to get patients to understand the damage they're doing. You know, somebody that's been smoking for 50 plus years doesn't want to hear it, and is okay with just continuing to their death. But every visit asking is, you know, are you motivated? What can we do to get you motivated to quit? And then go through the litany of options. It's not just, chewing gum or a patch anymore. There are lots of alternative options to get you to quit smoking.
Yeah, this is Patrick, the nursing student again. I wanted to go off of one of the things that Heidi just mentioned about assessing if the patient is motivated and also how much so. I think motivational interviewing is maybe a little bit overlooked or maybe just not recognized as much as it should or could be with healthcare providers in terms of not necessarily like cheerleading, but reframing the discussion with the patient to highlight their wins and their positives that they've experienced, whether that be, cutting back smoking to a half pack a day from a whole pack a day or dipping, just cutting back any at all is a big deal with an addiction like tobacco use, and that can affect the patient's ability to breathe and get oxygen to their vital organs dramatically. So that's, if that's the goal, and I mean, if something as cheap as a good discussion, a targeted focused discussion would be, I think that's definitely a tool that we need to use and be more willing to use, although it does take a little more time, which is unfortunate in today's healthcare climate.
So you briefly mentioned motivational interviewing, and we could certainly talk about it for a whole other hour, but I know that pharmacy students and certainly nursing students, PA students, you guys are all taught some version of motivational interviewing. So let's summarize what motivational interviewing is for our listeners who may know the process but may not know it by the same name.
Instead of coming at the patient accusing them of, say, smoking, it's more of, okay, this is maybe a bad habit, but giving them
I can take off from Heidi. This is Omar. So basically, motivational interviewing is just expressing and showing empathy towards the client, even though what they're doing may be not be the best for their interest in health. Just supporting them and basically developing the autonomy for the patient and respecting their decisions. Like I said, it may not be in their best interest for their health, but if that's what that patient is doing, you really can't tell the patient what to do. You can't change the patient unless the patient wants to change for the better for themselves. So that's a quick, brief summary of motivational interviewing, I would say.
I also think it's important as a provider to empathize with the patient, because the patient also often feels victimized by the provider telling them, stop doing this, don't do this, what you're doing is hurting you, what you're doing can kill you. But it's really helpful when a provider can tell the patient, like, look, I understand it's hard to lose weight, it's hard to quit smoking, but you're doing a good job. And a patient is just like a provider. We all need encouragement in everything that we do.
Right, totally. This is Patrick, the nursing student again. I like to think of it with all of those aspects, but also like meeting the patient where they are and then progressing from that point. And motivational interviewing, to get a little more specific about it, it uses four bullet point techniques, and it starts with the provider asking open-ended questions and then progresses to like assess where the patient is, and then progresses to affirming where the patient says that he or she is with weight loss or for example medication adherence or smoking cessation. And then the provider is supposed to kind of reflect and kind of actively listen and kind of show the patient that the provider is listening by just paraphrasing what was just said. And then at the end of the visit, there's a summary or summarization phase where you kind of wrap it up and kind of, in theory, you kind of tie it in a bow. It doesn't always happen that neatly, but in theory, that's how it goes.
This is Audrey. I want to kind of piggyback off of that. I think one of the biggest things that comes out of motivational interviewing is finding out the patient's motivation for changing their behavior. As providers, you know, the motivation to quit smoking for us is, well, you're not going to get lung cancer, you're not going to get COPD. But for the patient, it could be something as simple as maybe they don't get breaks at work anymore to smoke, so they need to cut back. And this is a way for us to ascertain what their motivation is so that we can tailor how to best change that behavior with them.
All right, you're listening to Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Medication Adherence and Safety. This is an interactive discussion, and our listeners are welcome to join the conversation. You can do so by dialing 515-605-9859 and pressing the number 1 to let us know you have a question or comment. You can also follow the discussion via Twitter at anaturalbridge, at UCSOP, or at IWillTakeMyMeds. We're talking with a variety of pharmacy, nursing, and physician assistant students regarding medication adherence this evening and how each of them works together in a team to really provide the best outcomes for patients. So, do you all believe that an interprofessional approach is necessary to really get at the best possible care for patients? And what are some examples, or why do you feel that is or is not the case?
This is Omar, the pharmacy student. So the patient is basically in our best interest, and we've been taught to have a patient-centered approach to achieve optimal outcomes. So when you have the nurse, the provider, the PA, and the pharmacist all together explaining the importance of the medication and how important it is to adhere to the medication and how detrimental it could be if you don't adhere to this medication, the patient is more willing to understand and would understand the pros and cons of taking this medication and not taking the medication in comparison to just the pharmacist telling the patient he should take this medication, or just the provider, or just the nurse. So I feel like when we all put the pressure on the patient and we're all explaining the importance of the medication, it would be better understood by the patient, and they would be more willing to adhere to the regimen.
I think as a PA, it's really beneficial to have the pharmacist and nursing at your side, because sometimes as a provider, you'll prescribe a medication and send the patient away, not realizing that that medication might not be covered, and the patient gets discouraged not knowing that they have other options. So instead of seeking other options, they might be too embarrassed, but when in actuality they could just go to the pharmacy, talk to the pharmacist, get other options, and know that this is not the end-all be-all, like there are other options.
So we should back up, and we've committed one of the cardinal sins of medicine by talking about something without really defining it. So let's talk a little bit more of what is interprofessional education for some individuals who may not know what that word actually means in this situation.
So this is Omar again. Basically, interprofessional medication or collaboration, I should say, is working as a team, not just specifically by yourself. So working with the nurses, working with the physicians to reduce medical errors, to improve the quality of care for the patients. And I believe once the providers, physicians, nurses, and pharmacists work together, it's in the best interest for the patient's health outcomes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, they always say, who's the most important person on the healthcare team? Well, that's really the patient, because whether you're the physician or the provider, the nurse or the pharmacist, everything that you're doing evolves around that patient. So I think working together, the patient has multiple points of contact should they have any questions or concerns along the way.
We do have a question that has come through via Twitter. How would you suggest to motivate patients to take their medications when their medications don't necessarily make them feel good or they may not see immediate benefits? How would you encourage someone to stick with it and continue taking something that they may not see immediate results from or actually make them feel worse before they get better?
This is Omar again. So here's a kind of a personal story I have in regards to a family member. My grandma, actually, she claims she feels great and does not need her blood pressure medications until I visit her and take her blood pressure, and her blood pressure is about 180 over 120. But she still claims that she feels great. And I kept explaining to her how you may feel great until the time comes and you can potentially have a stroke or a heart attack or whatever the case may be. And not too long ago, she was hospitalized, and she now understands that she has to take her blood pressure medication. So it took a hospitalization for her to understand that just because she feels good doesn't necessarily mean that the inside of her body feels good. So that's kind of my backstory on that.
I think that with hypertension especially is one of the hardest to encourage a patient, because it's notoriously known as the silent killer, because a patient doesn't experience day-to-day symptoms, which is great for their day-to-day life, but it's really hard to emphasize the importance of taking medications. So I think as hard as it is to say, you do have to tell them the scary things that can result as a consequence of not taking their medications.
So we've been discussing how the process should work and using each member of the healthcare team as kind of an individual cheerleader for the patient to make sure that they're getting appropriate care and that everything is going to plan and there's nothing falling through the cracks. But what are some consequences of when healthcare professionals don't work as a team or things kind of fall apart? How does this impact medication adherence and disease state management?
I mean, ultimately, you get poorer compliance rates. Your patient's not going to fully understand their condition or know why the provider's providing this medication. And, I mean, that's ultimately going to lead to poor outcomes for the patient. So if it's they're taking a medication for their blood pressure and the team isn't working together well, that could lead to a heart attack or a stroke for the patient. Same with any other of the chronic diseases that our patients may encounter. or even acute cases. Let's say you have pneumonia and you're given an antibiotic. I know after so many days you may feel better and you're like, well, there's still 5 pills left in this bottle. It is imperative that if the provider tells you or, you know, you're given an antibiotic that you finish the full course, even if you start feeling much better just within a couple days. So
definitely talking it through at each step of the process and reminding the patient that there certainly could be issues if they don't take the medication as prescribed, or even just to fix any kind of clerical issues that come up along the way. Patrick, with your hospital experience, tell us a little bit more about medication reconciliation and figuring out what patients are on when they come in, and then kind of comparing that to whatever changes are made whenever they're getting ready to head out of the hospital.
So I think in the emergency setting, which I most of my experience to date is with the emergency department, a lot of our time is I'll use the word unfortunately, spent clarifying what medications the patient's on and what medications, well, I should say what they're prescribed, and then B, what they actually do take. And that can, if there are a lot of tedious details where it's kind of like, well, yeah, I'm prescribed this, but I only take it this much, that can really pull us away from the patient and cause us to have more time kind of at the computer, which honestly, I don't think anybody really wants that. A lot of us get into the profession to help the patients that are presenting to us, and we're all kind of annoyed at the electronic healthcare record system. Those, going back to your previous questions about and the Twitter question about medication compliance and adherence with motivational interviewing, that is something that we could do for the patient in those times in the emergency department if we didn't have to sit at the computer and type stuff in and clarify what's going on. Things would be much more streamlined as they are, which could probably provide more open-ended, just more open and honest dialogue between the patient and the provider, I think.
That is a great point, and we're getting more and more questions coming in through Twitter. Definitely talking about talking. And the first question we have is, how often do the pharmacist and physicians, doctors, physician assistants talk to each other in regards to medications, side effects, alternative medications for a patient? So how often is that conversation happening between a provider and a pharmacist, for example?
So I think in the outpatient setting, but in the regular primary care clinic, it's been my experience that usually it's mostly the provider making the recommendations, giving the slips for the patient to take to the pharmacy, and then relying, hopefully on the other end, the pharmacist's end, on being able to, if it's not covered by a patient's insurance, or even if it is, but it's, you know, the copay is still ridiculously high, or if they catch, you know, any sort of medication interactions with something the patient's already on, you know, we're thankful that we have them to rely on to actually call us, let us know that, hey, something's not right, or, hey, what about this? You made this recommendation, but can I suggest something else, especially if it's not covered by the patient's insurance?
In my experience at an urgent care, I was able to call on the behalf of the physician and speak to pharmacists one-on-one and ask them their advice and what their preference was for interactions. So we were actually able to talk to them as often as we saw necessary.
Even in a specialty like dermatology, we had to work with a lot of specialty pharmacies, not just like your local CVS or Rite Aid. And I mean, I had a pharmacist on speed dial for each one of our specialty pharmacies that we used, and because they were so helpful. Use, you know, even as a provider, use your resources, which include the pharmacist.
This is Audrey. Most of my experience in pharmacy so far has been in the retail setting. And in a retail pharmacy, we actually work with the doctors and nurses and PAs a lot more than you think. The pharmacist spends a lot of their day on the phone talking to the prescribers, clarifying prescriptions, making recommendations to change therapies for patients. We do work with them a lot, and we definitely appreciate their input.
We have another question that has come in via Twitter. To what extent does the issue of over-medication play in medication adherence and disease control? So those patients that perhaps are getting more than 5 or maybe even more than 10 different medications, how does that affect their compliance and overall control?
This is Audrey again. When a patient is taking that many medications, it can be difficult, probably just for the patient to keep track of everything that they're taking. It can be really easy for a patient to forget a dose or forget what medication they're supposed to take at what time. That's where things like tools like the pill boxes or setting alarms on your phone come in handy with that.
I've noticed, this is Patrick with nursing again, I've noticed in the emergency setting when patients come in with maybe lists of their medications and they'll have kind of like they'll have it written out on a chart almost. Sometimes they'll be in a pill box, like it was just said, but also they'll have a chart basically with kind of the medications going down one column on the left side and then more columns of the hours in the day, and it'll kind of have X's in certain boxes when they take certain medications, if that makes sense. And those seem to be the patients who are maybe on top of their medication regimen and adherence, but also the ones, and I don't know if this is just coincidence or if there is an actual correlation with this, but those also happen to be the patients that seem to be the ones who are most willing to ask questions, even if they might feel... I feel like this is a harsh word, but like if they feel dumb asking a question, I generally don't know many healthcare providers that would actively, try to make a patient feel less than or dumb by just asking a question. I mean, a lot of patients don't work in the healthcare field. And so I wouldn't expect them to know certain things. Although I do believe that each patient and each person should take a pretty active role in their own healthcare, there comes a point when I don't blame somebody for not knowing a certain mechanism of action for some obscure medication they may or may not be taking. Like, that's totally fine.
Piggybacking on something that Patrick has said, it is imperative that if patients are on, you know, a bag full of different meds, it is not wrong for them to go to their, say, primary care provider, who should be, you know, if you've got a cardiologist, a heart doctor, a lung doctor, you name it, multiple specialists involved and everyone's got their fingers, you know, in your medication regimen. Don't hesitate to go back to your primary care provider and say, hey, this is my med list. Is there anywhere here that we can consolidate? Do I need these? Are these, you know, are there combination medications where we can actually, you know, make 3 of these into one? Anything that could make, you know, the patient's life a little bit easier and more likely for them to actually stay adherent to their regimen.
This is Audrey again. I think that's also a great role for the pharmacist, too, because we fill all the medications. We can see everything that the patient is taking, usually, if they're filling it at the same pharmacy. And so that's a chance for us to look down through their medication list and see, okay, they're on 2 different medications for the same disease state. Maybe we could do something about that. So that's a great way for us to get involved.
Yeah, just this is Omar, and just based off what Heidi was saying, combining medications in the community setting during my last rotation, I realized that one of the patients was taking Losartan and was also taking a thiazide diuretic for her hypertension, and I explained to the pharmacist that we could potentially call the physician, and I learned in school that there's one medication that merges Losartan and hydrochlorothiazide, and that saved the patient from taking a couple extra pills throughout the day, and the patient was very excited to hear that we had this option for her, and the provider agreed to it, and that, like I said, just saved the patient a few extra pills to take every single day for the remainder of however long she needs to be taking that regimen.
Yeah. And it's not always going to be the case where we're able to offer that. And at that point, then it will be, you know, as best as possible, trying to use the pill boxes, have it written out. You know, we loved it when people showed up to the ER with, you know, that little slip of paper in their wallet that had exactly what they were taking with their regimen on it. So that in a critical situation where you may not either, you know, be in the right mind or, you know, emotions run high, you don't have to sit there and try to remember the dose or what, because it can be a foreign language. You know, medications are not easy, even when we have to learn them in school. It's not easy to learn. So to expect a patient to remember exactly the meds, the names, the doses, it's a difficult task for anyone. So always keeping that little card in your purse or in your wallet could be helpful.
And speaking of that little card, we actually have some available through the Scripture Future program. You can find those at www.ucwv.edu/pharmacy and click on I Will Take the Pledge. There are wallet cards available for you to print out and write your medications on so that you can have that list with you if you're in some type of situation where you need to provide that to a healthcare professional. You're listening to Parent Talk Live, special edition, Medication Adherence and Safety. This is an interactive discussion, and you are more than welcome to call in by dialing 515-605-9859 and pressing the number 1 to let us know you have a question or comment. You can also tweet us at anaturalbridge, at UCSOP, and at IWillTakeMyMeds. Thanks to Nancy for that last question regarding over-medication or over-prescribing and how that affects adherence as well. We've had another question come in via Twitter as a follow-up to our earlier question on discussing how to let patients know that taking their medications is important, even though it may not make them feel great. And so the listener writes, as a teacher, I see students who and sometimes parents, who don't want to take or give medications to the patient because perhaps it's a behavioral drug and they don't like how it makes them feel. How do you motivate that patient? This is certainly a very difficult kind of subtype of issue, especially in discussing things like mental health. So how do we motivate those that may have other issues beyond what we've talked about earlier?
This is Omar again. In regard to that question, we should, of course, explain to the patient that once starting a new regimen of medication, they may not like the way they feel, or they may feel weird or may feel different, but we should explain that it's normal to feel that way at first. And, of course, if this feeling of weirdness continues, we can always call the physician and explain to the physician, and we can potentially get them on another regimen that would make them feel better. But I think that's an important part, is just to try it out first. You can't have that mentality that you take it once and you feel really weird and you just don't want to take it again, because it could just be your body is not adjusted to the medication or is not used to the medication. And we just give it a few days or maybe a week or two and see how you're feeling then, and then we can potentially go based off of that.
This is Audrey. I also want to add, if you do experience any sort of side effects that you don't really like and you're not sure how concerned you should be over them, you can always give your doctor or your prescriber a call and ask them about it. And they can tell you whether that's a normal side effect or whether that's something more concerning, but they can answer your questions about that as well.
This is Patrick. This is the nursing student. So, yeah, with a lot of medications, well, with some common medications for mental health, such as depression, an SSRI commonly makes people feel cloudy, is what I've heard, and also with, it's pretty common to have some GI symptoms, and clearly either of those would be enough to understandably make anybody not adhere to that regimen. And I think, like Audrey and Omar said, I think as long as there's that open communication with the provider, with the prescriber, then they could even possibly try out a different medication within that classification of medications and see if maybe the symptoms decrease or anything else. And I think while the GI symptoms, I mean, that could interact with the day-to-day activities, which is unfortunate. The cloudiness, I guess it depends on the level of cloudiness that a patient is feeling. I think during that motivational interviewing phase, maybe at the prescriber's office during your visit, to assess and ensure that the patient understands the value in what could be once the medication kicks in. Because for one of those specific medications in that class, the SSRIs, it takes weeks for it to build up in the system to a therapeutic level for the patient to feel the effects, which, I mean, that almost, aside from the other symptoms, is enough to be like, well, you know, for a patient to say, understandably, well, I don't feel any different, so why should I do this?
Certainly a difficult conversation, and we have several more questions coming in from Twitter that are a little bit more targeted to some of our guests as far as their specific areas of practice or areas of knowledge. So this one is for Omar and Audrey. How do automatic refills work? At times, I am off on schedule because the medication is not in stock. So what does missing one day of my medication do to my treatment? This is from Martin, and definitely not an easy blanket answer to give as far as what does missing one day of medication do to a treatment regimen. Certainly different with a wide variety of different medications. Some, it's more safe to do that than others. But can you guys explain a little bit of how the automatic refill process works?
Well, with the automatic refill process, most pharmacies offer some sort of automatic refill. About every month, if you're refilling your prescription every month, the pharmacy will go on ahead and refill that prescription for you, and it'll be ready for you to pick up. It does get a little bit off if the medication is out of stock, usually by a day. But usually they try to prevent that so that missing a day won't happen.
Yeah, this is Omar. And I would say, just based off my prior experience in a pharmacy, I say the pharmacists do a pretty good job in keeping the stock, especially once you build the relationship with your patients and you know what patients are coming in every month and what they're getting automatic refills on every month. So I would say pharmacists do a pretty good job in making sure the stock is there. In regard to missing a dose, we have had one instance where we didn't have enough of the medication to fill for that 1 month. For this one specific patient, we had, I believe it was 15 out of their 30 pills. And, of course, we would dispense those 15 pills and hopefully have the patient come back a couple days later until we get the rest of the medication and partial fill, like I said, in the meantime, and then finish off the remainder of the fill once they come back a couple days later. But, like I said, we try to do a pretty good job in maintaining our stock so that way all patients have their medications at all times.
We have another follow-up from Nancy, who earlier was asking about over-prescribing of medication, and I misinterpreted her question, meaning prescribing multiple medications, but she was actually talking about prescribing too much of a single medication. She reports, for example, after she had surgery, she no longer was in any pain, but the doctor prescribed another month of a narcotic pain reliever, We certainly could talk for at least another hour just about narcotics and overprescribing, which is certainly a component of Scripture Future. But what can patients do if they are getting excess prescriptions that are perhaps not something they're needing long-term, like pain medication? What kind of discussion can the patient have with their provider or any other healthcare member of what to do next?
Well, first of all, you can go ahead and tell your doctor or your prescriber that you don't want any more of that medication, and in most cases, they won't prescribe it if it's a narcotic like that. If they would give you too much that you don't need after that, there are plenty of ways to dispose of narcotics safely. There's the DEA drug take-back days, which happen twice a year, that you can actually take those medications and they can be disposed of properly. There are locations around here, we have them, I think, at some of the police departments where you can take back, like, narcotics.
I think it's a conversation that you can just have with your provider. Just if you don't want them, then you can tell them. And even if you want a different type of medication, it's not an end-all, be-all. Your physician or your PA will not tell you that you can only have this. It should be an open conversation that you can have with the provider, and they can change it, reduce the dose, or just not give it to you at all.
And if it's something you didn't walk out of the hospital with, it can always stop at the pharmacy.
Yeah.
You don't have to pick it up, even if a prescriber... Okay, but something like pain pills where you don't feel like you need them anymore, as opposed to your heart medication. And if it's pain pills and you're like, I'm not in pain, why would I pick these up? Don't. Leave them at the pharmacist. Tell them I don't need that.
And in regard to overprescribing, I think, of course, we all know about the opioid epidemic that we have going on. I think providers are doing a better job now in not overprescribing. For example, a wisdom tooth procedure. Some dentists were giving out 30-day prescriptions for hydrocodone when all you really need is a 3 to 5 day prescription, and of course taper off. But like I said, I think providers are doing a better job of realizing that overprescribing is actually leading to and all the addiction and the misuse and the distribution of these drugs. So I think they're doing a better job, I would say.
Yeah, and this is Patrick with nursing. I think that's a really good point. That everybody made is that it depends, especially like specifically to pain medication, it really depends subjectively on the patient, him or herself. There are some, like I think Heidi mentioned, that we mentioned earlier about like antibiotics, or like she mentioned with cardiovascular drugs, that you do need to, for instance, see your antibiotic regimen through to the end to make sure you don't lead on any like maybe super infections or any of the cardiovascular drugs to, you know, put yourself at unneeded risk for a heart attack or stroke. But pain medications, and I think this is a very specific place, a good example of where the patient comes in and the patient taking responsibility for his or her own health comes in to the quote healthcare team. This is, I mean, the patient is a part of his or her healthcare team, and to have the understanding that, hey, I'm aware that, you know, I may have X amount of pain pills left and I don't feel like I need them, to know that, you know, you don't have to take them. You can leave them at the pharmacy, or if you've already got it filled and you're maybe halfway through your medication regimen, then you don't have to continue taking them. And like Audrey said, you can take them to a DEA drop-off site at the appropriate time. Then having that, I think, it is pretty key. And having that, responsibility, each patient can have that responsibility for themselves.
And if
well,
you do find
you
yourself...
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you do find yourself with an excess amount of medication, especially pain medication, you can always go to the pharmacy. And I know pharmacies don't take back controlled substances, but they do provide you with things such as medication disposals. There's these little packets where you can put up to 30 pills at a time, mix it up with some water, shake it up, and it just safely disposes of your medication. So that's just another thing I wanted to mention.
Certainly a great conversation this evening about interprofessional education, working together as a team, and also involving the patient in their care process. So thank you for listening this evening to Medication Adherence and Safety. Again, a lot more conversation to be had, but we are unfortunately just about out of time. So you can join us next week. We'll be here again Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for our last of the four-part series relating to medication adherence and safety. Again, you can still continue to follow the conversation beyond our show this evening at A Natural Bridge, at UCSOP, and at I Will Take My Meds. Thank you all very much for listening, and see you next week.